Okay, it's already 8:31.
Yes, so, there you go. Yes, that's good, the clock.
And I'm not going to talk about Rabbi Goldstein. That's not, unless
it's, I agree. But, I'm just saying.
Yeah, but it's, and I'm not going to, I'm just going to spend like 5 minutes, even less, on responding. I have a bunch of stuff, but I need to finish, as they say in the media, of a hard stop. I really need to finish by the next class. So I'm going to hold. If I have time at the end, I'll get to some of these. I want to see how far we get, but I really want to get into what we're doing. But before we do it, I'll just very, very quickly, only with relevance to things we discussed in the last class. But first, let me give you the date. It's December 20th, 2021. I want to quickly just share. I'll share my screen here for a second. Rabbi, did you give me the ability to share my screen?
Yeah. You're co-host. Okay, you can share.
Okay, very good. Oh, actually, I pulled up something here that wasn't even what I was intending, but since I pulled it up first, I'll show it to you. This is the issue we're going to be discussing is not about women being halachic authorities, and that wasn't what the Orthodox have dealt with. I'll get back to the Orthodox for a few minutes, and it's not what the conservative. The issue is about positions of authority for halachic and meta-halachic reasons, not about deciding halacha. I already told you the Sefer HaChinuch. This is the Chidah. It's in Birkei Yosef, Chaim David Yosef Azulai. Remember, he's the one who has the section in Shema Gedolim called Rabbanit. But if you look in Choshen Mishpat, Siman Zion, Halacha Yud Beis, he says as follows. Even though a woman can't be a dayan, that's going to be very important for Lieberman. Even though hardly any rabbis are dayanim, we'll see what Lieberman says about this, and we'll ask ourselves, is he really going on a stretch? But even though an isha can't be a dayan, he says, but a wise woman can pasken shayla. So if anyone were to tell you that a woman can't be a halachic decisor, a poseket, that is not in accord with our Masorah. It's if the woman has the knowledge, you can have loads and loads of sources. But I mentioned the Chidah because the Chidah is not just some rabbi. The Chidah is in the Sephardic world in particular, after the Shulchan Aruch, before you get to, let's say, Chacham Avadi Yosef, he is the leading authority, I think, in the Sephardic world. He's the only one they called Maran. But that's not what I wanted to show you. What I wanted to show you is a few things. First, I saw this online today on YouTube, a talk on May 27th. I don't know who Karen Kirschbaum is. But she also discusses Rabbi Saul Lieberman using his knowledge of Hellenistic culture and society to gain deeper insights into rabbinic ordinances. So we only spoke a little about that. You can check that out. It's not true. Rabbi Lieberman, though, was not a doctor, as we saw, although he was an honorary doctor. There's a few things in the news also of relevance. Just this week, believe it or not, or last week, more Orthodox Jewish women are ordained, changes uneven. This is from the AP. And they focus a bit on, there's a shul in Philadelphia called the South Philadelphia Shtibel with a female rabbi. Then there was an article by, where is it here? In Tablet, also last week, or this week, Tamar Ross, about feminism changing the study of Jewish thought. So these are really important issues which are not going away. And I don't think we know how it's going to develop. Rabbi Lamb, he gave an interview about 30 years ago, and he said he was honest. He said he doesn't know if there'll be Orthodox women rabbis, but he's not putting it off the table because especially when we're not dealing with pulpit per se, things have been developing. Also, I listened to the tape last week. For those who only listened, you might have – where is it? Here it is. I wasn't clear when I was giving the surveys, and I said that 24% of open Orthodox support rabbis. That's somewhat support. Strongly support is 60. So for the open Orthodox, are 84%. One more thing on women rabbis. I didn't tell you the result in this book. The rabbi of Buchenwald. About Rabbi Schachter. Remember, I told you last week there was a problem because the Orthodox wouldn't accept Reform woman chaplain, even though they accept a Reform male chaplain. And the way it worked with the chaplaincy was that all them, the Orthodox, Reform, and Conservative, all together had to approve each nominee to be a chaplain. So the way they solved it, he explains on page 392, is they just changed the system. Previously, each nominee required the approval of the entire group, consisting of four representatives, each of three denominations. The new rule was that, no, it's only each group submits their own. So that solves the problem. The Orthodox submit theirs, the Reform submit theirs, and the Orthodox don't have to be involved in submitting a female rabbi. Remember, they were involved in submitting non-Orthodox male rabbis, and that was not a problem. So it's a little strange there. And finally, I thank Jacob Sasson. We spoke about, well, first I was speaking about women, Yoetzot, and I said that in the Hasidic world, they'll go to the Rebbetzin, and she can answer the question. And Baruch challenged me, is that really true? And I said, well, I don't know, that's what I heard. Well, there's a Hasidic Dayan who listens to the shows, and I asked him. And he said that he doubts that a Hasidic Rebbetzin will give answers to any Nida questions, unless it was like a very basic sort of question. But really, isn't that, aren't we told that the Yoetzet only answers basic questions? So I don't know how different it is. But I thank Jacob Sasson, because I made a big point last class that in the Sephardic world, you never had this idea of going to rabbis with these questions and showing them things for them to make decisions about. And I mentioned Yemen and North Africa. And Jacob Sasson sent to me that the chief Sephardic rabbi of Argentina, Rabbi Shehebar, it is Chuvot Yitzchak Yeranein, page 258, says as follows, quote, V'asher l'inyan marot ha-damim, say it like Sephardic, because he's a Syrian, Hine lo nahagnu bazeh klal, ki me'olam lo ra'iti rabbanim ba'aram tzova, shetipu bazeh. He said that the rabbis never involved themselves with this. They gave basic instructions to the women, and this was only a women's issue. So, as I said, this whole idea of Yoetzet is not a, it has very, very old traditions in the Sephardic world, and this is sort of something which is really, is, I don't know why it's not known, but it's not. Okay. We have interesting stuff now. I want to, we're going to get right into now the dispute over which really leads, hey, as we'll see, we saw Lieberman comes to the seminary in the 40s. In the 40s, and he writes this letter to the Agudas Rabbanim. And he says, as long as the seminary is bound by Shulchan Aruch, by Halacha, I can accomplish a great deal there, and there's a lot to be done. 40 years later, we're going to see everything has changed and all those great hopes have totally collapsed. So how do we get there? Well, I want to pick up now, as I said, with the what happened in the seminary. I gave an introduction last class in the Orthodox world. I want to make one, maybe an adjustment, maybe, I guess a little adjustment. I did say, and it's absolutely correct, and anyone could read the OU statement. The stress is on meta halacha. It's on Mesorah. It's they stated explicit. They talk about how the sanctity of the synagogue demands an enhanced level of modesty. That's why you have mechitza, the idea of a woman speaking in public. They speak all about Mesorah and tradition. They do. I didn't mean to imply that there's no halacha in it. They speak about sorah, women having authority, which raises certain questions, especially for the Rambam. We'll get to that. But that's only done in two paragraphs, and they acknowledge in the essay here that, I believe it's on this one, where they say that not everyone agrees with this issue. I mean, is a Rabbi Sarara? He's appointed, and then he's let go. And then they talk about the issue of, which comes from Lieberman, if the current rabbis have to be based off classics, Smicha Dayanim. But that's it. That's all in one page. The rest of it is really all, and I think this is the correct way to argue, that it's about tradition. And so anyone who's interested, please read it. The conservatives are, of course, coming from a different perspective. They're not bound as much to tradition. And by the time this issue of women rabbis really hits the fore, women were already counted in a minyan. In 1973, already, women were counted in a minyan in by conservative Judaism. Here, for instance, this even made the New York Times. Look at this. Front page of the New York Times. Front page. Conservative Jews vote for women in minyan. And it begins, in a radical break with rabbinical tradition, conservative Judaism will allow women to be counted in the minyan. So how is it that if you're already going to be counting women in a minyan, not having him as rabbi, you're giving him aliyahs also? It's it was a little strange. So let me tell the story here, because it's a very interesting story. You can see it in a few places. First of all, you can see it in this book I showed you last week. Pamela Nadel, Women Who Would Be Rabbis, A History of Women's Ordination. But if you really want to get to this story with all the details, an article in this big volume I showed you last week, Tradition Renewed, Volume 2 by Beth Wenger. And I'll just going to go through it quickly, the major points of this that she makes, because it's really an excellent article, and it has all the research and the stuff at the seminary. It begins, of course, by talking about the pressure that begins in 1972. A group called Ezrat Nashim, the conservative movement, they demanded that the rabbinical assembly take up their demand for women to be given full rights. That's going to be the minyan. That's going to come to fruition the next year with the minyan. But this is pushing that women rabbis as well. Now, the rabbinical assembly, this is also an important part of the story. Who is going to decide for conservative Judaism? Is it the rabbinical assembly or is it the Jewish Theological Seminary? Another important thing is that in 72, Gerson Cohen comes in and as chancellor. And he's much more positively inclined to the women's issue. And as we'll see, the ordination issue as well. But I know a lot of people like to blame Gerson Cohen. I already mentioned a number of classes ago that a certain very traditionalist conservative rabbi said, he told me that Gerson Cohen was a secularist. Now that's clearly a canard. It's not true, but there were such negative feelings. And the attitude was that Gerson Cohen is responsible for this. He's not responsible. He was responding to changes in the views of the laity. He might have pushed the matter before it needed to be pushed from the conservative perspective, but this is the way the winds were going. If it wasn't Gerson Cohen, it would have been someone else. The people at the seminary were living in a little bit of a bubble, as we'll see, and the country, at least, the conservative movement was ready for this change. But then Wenger, of course, deals with Gerson Cohen. The Cohen's problem was that strong opposition, which we'll see in the seminary itself. So how to get around this? So, of course, in all these cases like this, you have groups, you study the matter, you send it out, what do the people at the pews have to say? Let's study it. And often people, that's a way of, forgetting about the matter or just putting it aside. We'll study it. But no, this wasn't going to be possible. When Cohen first comes in, what he says, Wenger quotes him as saying, and this continued to the late 70s. Cohen's position was that if we ordain women, it's going to tear the movement apart. But that position would soon change. She continues, of course, the counting the women in a minyan, that becomes important. Like I said, how can you have women counting in a minyan and not have women as rabbis? The women as rabbis appear to most people not a halachic matter. Counting women in a minyan is more problematic from a halachic standpoint, at least according to most. It's ironic for me to say this now because you have Orthodox synagogues which count women in a minyan. But this was the traditionalists and conservative movement saw counting women in a minyan as the beginning of the surrender to feminism. And we'll see soon what David Novak and others have to say. Yeah. So who's going to make this decision? The rabbinical assembly is pushing it. The seminary is saying, and in fact, Rabbi Cohen's uncle, Rabbi Wolf Cohen, Wenger quotes him on page 490, that The rabbinical assembly does not pass resolutions about matters which belong to the seminary. Well, the rabbinical assembly wasn't happy about this because the people in the seminary, most of the people in the Talmud faculty were considered Orthodox by them. So how can they make decisions for what's, and by the way, in the seminary synagogue, you never had women counted in the minyan, even though the rabbinical assembly passed this. Everything remained the same. In the main minyan, there was a machitza there. So these are the people that are going to be deciding for the conservative movement. Already you have a problem. Wenger also points out, I mean, I could spend a whole class just on her article, but I want to pick the important points out, that she then moves to deals with the traditionalists. And one of the major traditionalists, and we'll see what we're going to see from him today, is David Novak, because David Novak's an interesting situation here. David Novak was one of the leaders in opposition to women ordination, and yet now he's one of the big advocates, and his own daughter was ordained by Yeshivat Maharat, and he tries to thread the needle to say that he was right then and he's right now. Doesn't make sense. We'll see what he says, and perhaps it is correct that Lieberman wouldn't oppose at least Maharat as opposed to Rabbaz. We'll get to that in a few minutes. But so he deals with Novak. And then the big issue was they set up a commission. You know, as Gerson Cohen says, we have to study this. And as Wenger says, and they had open hearings to discuss this. The commission's open hearings constituted an unprecedented event in the decision-making process of the conservative movement. Never before had a crucial issue of conservative Judaism, particularly one rooted in halakha, been discussed in a nationwide public forum. So here you're giving it to the masses. And remember, these masses were not, remember when I told you what Salman Shachar Catholic Israel is a higher Frankel, you have to go with the people, but the people have to be the observant ones. It can't be just anyone who goes to synagogue. If you don't keep kosher, you're not a Shomer Shabbos, how are you, and when I say not Shomer Shabbos, I mean in accordance with the conservative approach. Remember, only driving to shul on Shabbos. Later, if we have time today, I'm going to read you what Theodore Friedman writes, because I read the second volume in the one that Glinken pointed out. He has a whole thing saying that everyone's misunderstanding their response. And not only that, the Committee on Jewish Law and Standards comes out explicitly and says that even though you can ride to shul, it's only to shul. You can't ride to any other. You can't even ride to do Bikur Cholim. You can't ride to go to another shul, let's say 40 minutes away, instead of your normal shul for a bar mitzvah, because they feel that this is destroying the whole I'll get to that. But we're going to give the average person the right to decide halacha? Absolutely not, they're saying. The first reports which they got showed that the female support of female rabbi only had a slight majority. So if you want to criticize, let's say, Gerson Cohen, you could say he pushed it maybe 5 years, 10 years before there was any sort of unity in the movement. But then she goes on and she calls attention to that Cohen, in the early years of his tenure, said that, quote, religious change should not be brought about by popular pressure. However, by the end of the 70s, after seeing that there was a strong support, even if only, it's only a few percentages in support of it, but you could see which way the direction is going. So by the end of this commission's work, Cohen says that he is, quote, passionately in favor of ordination of women. So now you have the majority of the rabbinical assembly rabbis, you have the majority of the conservative laity, even if it's not overall a majority, and you have the chancellor, and you have the sense that in the movement itself that is moving in that direction. In other words, if you looked in the 60s, it would have been majority opposed to it. If you look in the 70s, it's majority in favor. And as you go forward, you know it's every year it's going to be, especially as the youngers get older, it's going to be more in favor. So the question is, do you get in front of it or not? And what happened, what really put the issue to the front, this I think was fascinating, is that the rabbinical assembly, they would take people into rabbinical assembly, even if they didn't graduate from the seminary, if they were working in a conservative synagogue or if they're involved in larger Jewish communal work. Now, what happened was there was a reform rabbi, who, I'll show you her name if I can, a Reform rabbi named Magidson. But she was working in Jewish communal work, and she asked if she could be a member of the RA. She was working in Hillel. And lo and behold, the final tally was 210 in favor of admitting her and 75 opposed. But only four short of the seven. They needed a 75% majority for membership. But the overwhelming majority of the RA supported allowing in a female rabbi. So from Gerson Cohen's perspective, as Wenger describes it, you know, this is a disaster because the next time it comes up, they're going to vote her in. And you, this is a back door. You can't have the rabbinical assembly allowing women to come into the rabbinical assembly when the Jewish Theological Seminary itself is not ordaining women. What could that? That could lead to women's ordination in a non-conservative fashion. So that really pushed the issue. You can read all about and hear about the conflict here. Even Ismar Shorsch, in 1979, he was worried about this, and he writes to Cohen. He doesn't think that we should push this forward. Why? Because we're going to lose, he says, renowned members of the faculty, thinking of Lieberman and others. But this did not affect Cohen. So by the end of the 1970s, it was clear that this is going to come to the fore. Cohen and the rabbinical assembly are pushing women rabbis, faculty members, in particular the Talmud faculty. After all, they're the ones who are going to be training them. If you teach Jewish history or American Jewish studies at the seminary, even though eventually you're going to have a vote on this, well, what's that relevant to you? Well, you're not teaching the rabbis. They're strongly opposed to this. A vote was scheduled in 1979, and before this scheduled vote, a group of faculty members from the seminary, as well as traditionalist conservative rabbis, they form a group. Actually, the group was formed a little before, but they have they convene. It's called, quote, the Conference on Halachic Process. The argument is going to be that the conservative movement is violating halachic process, Gerson Cohen. And at this conference, you have five members of the faculty arguing that women cannot serve as rabbis. Lieberman sent a letter to this conference. It's published for the first time in Lieberman and the Orthodox. I thank Rabbi Ronald Price, who gave me a copy of it. It's dated Cheshvan Tufshin Mem, so that's fall of 1979, and it's addressed to the Conference on Halachic Process. And he says, I am happy to hear that a large number of my students and friends have decided that to get together to decide how to guard over Hagachelet HaAcharonah Shel Halacha, how to guard over, to watch over the last ember of Halacha that it not be put out. Yishar kochachem. He says, don't let your spirits fall if you're the minority, because Chazal already told us in Maseches Peah, they say there, afilu tishim v'tisha omrim avos, they talk about what to do Peah. If 99 people say to do it the wrong way, and one person says to do it the right way, lazesh shomim, shamar kalacha. When it comes to halacha, if the majority, even the overwhelming majority, say to do it one way, but the minority is right, well, then you're in the majority. So that's what Lieberman tells them. And the last embers here in 1979, he's saying, you are the ones, the last embers of halacha at this institution and in this movement. And when he comes to the movement, comes to the institution 40 years before, he had all these high hopes that as long as the Shulchan Aruch was in charge, that it would be okay. But it wasn't. The last thing I want to tell you from Wenger is, so what pushed this, this vote that they were supposed to have was tabled in the end of in 1979, because they took a vote and whatever, it was tabled. And, but it would come to the fore again in the early 1980s. And this was after Lieberman dies in 1983. So this also is a chance to bring it forward. So how to bring it forward? Exactly. What's going to be the argument? Rabbi Joel Roth, student of Lieberman, but the one who took an independent stand in this, he, I guess, wanted to make a pshara, a compromise, I guess you could say. And he puts forth the argument, and he writes about this as well, that we should allow women to be ordained, provided they accept upon themselves, and he argues that they can do this halachically, the mitzvah sasei shezman grama. That is, women are obligated as men in all the mitzvot. Now, this is a strange thing, I think, because if you recall, in the Orthodox movement, no one ever raised this. This was never an issue at all. And why should it be an issue? What does being a rabbi have to do with, putting on tefillin or talis and all that? But in the conservative movement, the rabbi has to run the show often. And you can't have the rabbi on the other side of the mechitza. The rabbi has to be a shliach tzibur. And it just was incomprehensible that the rabbi would not have the same obligation as the congregants. And that then becomes a position advocated by a number. It was actually, well, I'll read you in a second where this was adopted. You find it interesting, I think. By now, Lieberman's gone. The seminary takes a vote, and the motion passes 34-8. And, other than some people in the Talmud faculty, it's an overwhelming victory. Immediately, Amy, the first class of women come in, and Amy Alberg, we know, is the first one, because she's ordained in 85. She had already been at the seminary taking classes. You could take classes. It's just you couldn't be ordained. So that's the history of it, basically. As told by Wenger. What I want to show you, what's fascinating, is that at least until, I don't know, someone today can tell me, I'm sure we have people listening, until 2002, at least, because that's when I have the document from the Rabbinical Assembly, women who were admitted to JTS had to accept the equality of obligation of mitzvot, including talis and tefillin and tefillah three times a day. This is a strange thing because this was never the practice at conservative synagogues. It was not the case at the Ziegler School in Los Angeles, but until at least 2002, and it might be, as far as I know, it might be today as well. Someone could tell me if it is, that Joel Roth's position became the obligatory for people who wanted to become rabbis at the seminary in New York. But this idea... Joe Roth believed that women to be counted in a minion, they had to accept all this upon themselves. This never became the practice in the conservative movement. And I don't think there's a conservative synagogue in the whole country that requires a woman to accept upon herself the mitzvos to be counted in a minion. And other authorities in the conservative movement did not accept this. There's another article, those who are interested, just came out 2021 in the Journal of Law and Religion, Emmanuel Bach. Gender equality in religious law, the ordination of women as rabbis in the conservative movement as a case study. This is a valuable article for two reasons. First of all, he goes into more detail about Joel Roth's position and his argument. Where do you get this idea that women can take upon themselves the mitzvah? So if a woman is not obligated in mitzvah sasecious mangrum, a positive time on commandments, who said that she could take it upon herself? So that's the argument Joel Roth makes. There's also the problem that the Shulchan Aruch is explicit that women can't be counted in a minion. So that's a bit of an issue. But also, he deals with Halivni. David Weiss Halivni. Here it is. He wrote this essay, which is available at the seminary library. It never was published. He didn't want to publish it. He's very strong against ordination of women, but also because he doesn't see how women could be counted in a minion. And if you can't be counted in a minion, and how could you be a rabbi? Just again, to stress, this was never an issue in the Orthodox world, and it's not an issue now. But at the end of his essay, he speculates, using halachic arguments, that perhaps, I shouldn't say that. There's not that much. It's very weak in halachic arguments. He says, perhaps if a whole generation of women took upon themselves these practices, maybe the next generation, when you have, in other words, this could become like a new practice, a new minhag Yisrael, which would allow women to be counted in a minyan. But they say he didn't want to include it because he knew this was never going to happen and it wasn't an issue. And this was pushed through and this never became a point that you have to count women for a minyan and shuls all over the country. It wasn't an issue. And therefore, he knew this was never going to be a practice. Even if people commit, women commit at the seminary to doing it, once they leave the seminary, it's just never going to be, it's never going to be a reality. And therefore, he withdrew it. He says in the last page of the responsa, this is what he says. The rapidity with which the decision to ordain women is being foisted on us has prevented us from studying the subject dispassionately and has precluded any possible solution that further study may yield. Pressure to ordain women through public hearings and media releases is an affront to all those who take halakha seriously. That is a halakha based on revelation as interpreted by the sages throughout the ages. A position to which the seminary is committed from its very inception. Then he goes on to say that what we're doing now is breaking with the historical school, which was the conservative movement's old tradition. He says, what's the rush? Let's study this. Let's see what's going on, etc. I'll read you in a few minutes what he says in his memoir about this. I want to show you another book. I just happened to read this last week. Ruth Weiss, in her new memoir, Free as a Jew, a personal memoir of national self-liberation. I forgot to put a picture up on her, but I'm sure many of you know what Ruth Weiss looks like, and she certainly made her mark as a leading public intellectual, and I guess you'd call her a neoconservative. I found this book interesting for a different reason, because when I was at Harvard at the end, she came and took over the Center for Jewish Studies there, a complete turnaround in Harvard from, as she calls it, the yeshiva run by Tversky. And it was the yeshiva to a certain extent. And only now, looking back, do I see how inappropriate some of the things there were for a university. I'll just give you one example. So we have the classes once a week. We meet Professor Tversky, 2 hours, say 1 to 3, let's say, and then we have a break for 15 minutes or 20 minutes, and then we'd have Professor Septimus or whoever. Well, in the winter, it's time to daven mincha. So there's a room, it was I, as I recall, room I on Widener. It had Harry Wolfson's library, so you still had his books there with his notes. So here we're sitting there, and there was classes for graduate students, although you had a number of undergraduates, very exceptional undergraduates. Noah Feldman was one of them. But you had men, of course, and you had women. So what would happen? We finished the first class, and then all of a sudden the women, it's like, you have to leave because we're davening mincha. What do you mean we have to leave? This is a secular university. We should have gone out into the hallway. Yeah, but it was run sort of like a yeshiva. Now, mind you, the only yeshiva in the country in which there was a shir and more nevuchim and chastai kreskas. But it was very much in that mode. So Ruth Weiss is going to totally change it and open it up so you can have conferences on neoconservatism and all interesting, instead of just focusing on rabbinic literature, which is all Tversky focused on. So I found that quite of interest. But on page 228, she talks about this matter, and she doesn't come from an Orthodox or even a traditional conservative background, but she's talking about how even someone as deficient in Talmudic expertise as I could see that the movement's cautious and conservative approach to innovation had been unceremoniously sacrificed to modern feminist pressure. So she writes all about, and she wrote an article and commentary about how the conservative movement is not doing this, not making a change for women's ordination because it's time, you know, society's changed. Instead, they're being pushed by the extreme feminists to push in this direction. which I don't know if that's true. That was where the people were at, I think. The conservative movement has to be where the people are at. It always has to be where the people are at. It takes a little while for the movement to catch up. That's why I wonder how long before the conservative movement starts doing intermarriages. We already know there's some conservative rabbis who support doing intermarriages. But since the conservative movement, just like in the reform movement, what is it, 60, 70% of the children intermarry now? How, and yet you can't, the rabbis can't be involved with this. So anytime that happens to a child of conservative parents, they have to bring in a reform rabbi or an independent rabbi. How long can that go on? The conservative movement always has to be in line with the laity. So it's, but that's, so you can read all about here, Ruth Weiss, coming at it from just an anti-feminist, when I say feminist, I don't mean feminist that women should have equal rights, anything like that, but just the idea that women have to be like men and that the ideology pushing matters like ahead of, before their time. Well, Lieberman was asked by his students what he has to say about women's ordination. The matter is, it would have been crazy had he not been asked. The matter is tearing apart the seminary. It's tearing apart conservative Judaism to a certain extent. It will lead to a bit of a split, as we'll see. So it would have been crazy had Lieberman not been asked. And he was asked. And he wrote a response, which we will look at right now. And he makes a halachic argument for in favor of, in opposition to women's ordination. The first one to make it. Before Lieberman came around with this argument, the attitude was, this is crazy. Women's ordination, who ever heard of such a thing? But a lot of things were thought to be crazy. There was a time women voting was thought to be crazy. Women becoming lawyers and doctors and bank presidents and presidents of America. There was a time, but so times change. So if times change, you have to explain why women in every area can reach the heights of their professions, but not in the synagogue. He wrote a response. You can find an English translation of it online, and you can follow. Well, you can go. You can see where it is, and you can open up your computer if you want. But I'm just going to start. I'm going to summarize for you what he says. Lieberman, first of all, who was he addressed to? As you can see, it's addressed to Dimitrovsky, Halivni Weiss, Zotnik, Faur, Frankis. These are the Talmud, this is the Talmud faculty at the seminary. Now, David Novak says that he was involved very much in getting Lieberman to write this, but it wasn't addressed to him. It was addressed to the people at the seminary who were going to be voting on it. And of course, the question is, they asked him, can women be ordained? Now, Lieberman says, I hadn't, you know, answered this question before for hidden reasons. I didn't want to make my opinion publicly known. I'm not sure. Maybe he runs away from disputes. But now I'm going to give the answer. In fact, he says, in the English translation, it says, but now I am afraid that it is forbidden me to deny kindness to others, to evade and not respond. This is actually an incorrect translation. The translation, the Hebrew says, "Achshav chosesh ani asur li limnoa bar lehitchamek v'lo la'orot." What does that mean, limnoa bar? Bar is like grain, corn. Not corn maize, but corn like in the Bible, biblical corn. Now, he says, I'm afraid that asur li limnoa bar. Now, the translator of this didn't know what limnoa bar meant. He thought limnoa bar meant like you're not giving someone some food. So he translated denying kindness. No, that's not what it means. This is a melitza. It comes from Tractate Sanhedrin 91b. It says as follows. Ko hamonea halacha mipi Talmud. Anyone who withholds the halacha from a student, even the... even fetuses in their mother's womb curse him. As it is stated, Monea Bar Kavuhu. So that's a pasuk they derive from, where's the pasuk is in?
Mishlei.
Yeah, Mishlei, here it is. I brought it up, 11:26. Monea Bar Yikvuhu Leom. If you withhold corn, the people shall curse him. But so the Gemara, it's a melitza. So when you say moneavar, it doesn't mean withhold kindness. It means withhold the halachic ruling. If you're asking me what the halach is, I'm going to tell you what the halach is. And what Lieberman states, he gets into the issue, can a woman be a dayan? And that's how he approaches this whole matter. And this is already, you look in the Rambam, the Shulchan Aruch, and according to the standard approach, women cannot be a dayan. We're going to see next class, I think, not this class, there's a Tosfos, however, who has a different approach. But that if the men accept her, she can. That will give an opening. But the Rambam says that, and many other halachic sources, woman is not a dayan. And he says, we have never found an isha dayanet, a female dayan, not in the days of Tanaim, not in the days of Maraim, not in medieval period. Okay, so then, fine. Now, you say that a woman can't be a dayan. And the Gemara will derive this. But why can't, what does this have to do with being a rabbi? Here's the step that Lieberman makes, which is the step, a step too far for many. He says that we have to examine what is smicha in our day and age. Original smicha was this tradition going all the way back, and teacher did it to student, and then it was lost, probably, I guess, due to the persecutions, I think they say, in the Talmudic period. So we don't have real smicha. This was something that the Ashkenazim started up again. The Sephardic world never had it. It's the Abarbanel who says it's like a university degree. It's like a diploma stating that you are worthy of deciding halacha. So Lieberman explains that he talks all about what smicha is in today's day and age, why we do it. He says that the smicha we have today has it's a zecher with smicha. It's like a remembrance of the original smicha. And like I said, the reason we give it to people so we know that they weren't to follow the sages. And he says that in Lithuania, they would even give young people smicha who are not at the level of deciding questions. Just like today, every year, all these rabbinical schools, Orthodox yeshivas, they graduate people. These people can't paskin. So what do we give them smicha for? Because it's a way to encourage them to become greater talmidei chachamim. And he gives a proof that this is okay. You can do this. So he speaks all about smicha. And then he says that this explains why when rabbis today, when they give smicha to people, they don't say, generally, you don't say yora, yora, yadin, yadin. Looking at my wall here, it just says yora, yora. Because yadin, yadin, because these people, they're not really going to be deciding halacha questions. It's just a te'udah, the edut. They're not going to be real dayanim. Sorry, but they're going to. We're saying that they can decide halakha questions im yashichu lamod if they continue to study. And he says that in Lithuanian yeshivas, often they didn't even write yor yor yadin yadin if the people were they didn't think they were big enough talmidei chachamim. Instead, they just called them rabbi, with the idea eventually, maybe he'll become learned. Okay. So now Lieberman has told us that women can't be dayanim, and then he spoke about what is this thing that smicha that we have today, and what does it mean? So what does this have to do then? What's the connection? That's the last paragraph. He says that if you look at the sources, we see that the name rabbi, the title rabbi, shows that someone is able to give halachic decisions. Halachic decisions. Women, a woman is possible to be a dayan. We should not give her, he says, the title, even as a melitza, he says, because the title rabbi is a direct continuation and is related in so many ways, modeled after what it was when we had real smicha. In other words, our smicha is modeled after, and the title rabbi is modeled after the original idea of giving smicha and being a dayan. And they would, the Dayan would be a Dayan and a Bastin. So now we're not in the Bastin necessarily, but you have the authority to decide halacha. That's what the title rabbi is. And you shouldn't use that title, which is reserved for, it's related, he's saying, to the original rabbis who had real smicha. And he says, we should not make ourselves, this is how he ends it, make ourselves a mockery. That's what he says. So it's like, it's a real stretch here, because he's not saying that there's any, he's not dealing with a woman having any clergy position. That's what the OU is dealing with. He's not dealing with issues of authority. He's dealing with the issue, the title rabbi. He's not even saying a woman can't decide halacha. But the title rabbi is not something that should be given. It's reserved for men who are the continuation of the old smicha, which gave them the rights to be dayan. And that was the issue then. Remember, ordaining as a rabbi, the idea that you ordain someone and give him a different title, the idea that someone would have a clergy position, that wasn't even a concept then. The idea was you're going to ordain someone and give them the title rabbi. And Lieberman says you can't do that. The title specifically is a continuation and related to the ability to be a dayan, to the old smicha. And this is directly connected to the old smicha, the new smicha, and it has to be reserved for people who have it. Otherwise, you're making a mockery of the whole term. And that's Lieberman's position. Is this compelling? Are we going to base a position on this? It's weak. I think the OU's position is much stronger, because you can reply to Lieberman, oh, fine, we won't call them rabbis. We'll call them something else. But what's the problem with them? Lieberman didn't deal with, doing funerals, running a synagogue. Lieberman didn't deal with any of those things. He dealt with more of like a technical thing. And I'm sure he opposes it for all sorts of other reasons as well, but that's not the response of. So for the opposition to win rabbis, I think the OU position is a much better position, although we'll see Rav Schechter. He likes what Lieberman says, but it's much better. I would only add to this, however, this idea that a woman couldn't be a dayan, if you want to, you could challenge it as well. What do I mean by that? Well, there's a number of sources I could show you, but here's one very easy one. Eliezer Chadad came out with about 150-page booklet, Al Ma'amadan Shel Nashim Bevatei Din Rabbaniim. It's dealing with the role of women in the rabbinic courts. I just mention this because it has the sources very handy. If you read this, you'll see all the rabbis who've discussed the fact that although the Rambam says that a woman can't be a dayan because Sarara, or you can find, that's really the reason, leadership, there's also Tosfos. And Tosfos holds that a woman, if the community accepts, if you accept the woman, like Devorah, let's say, then you could. So, in other words, there are sources there that open it up, even if you want to argue just from the Lieberman perspective, if you want to make the claim, and there have been some who have made it, the idea that a woman, you could accept upon yourself the woman. Now, he's dealing with Batei Din in Israel. So he's interested in more of can the government then, as representative of the democratic system, declare that women can be on the Beis Din? Does that work? Or does it have to be in each individual case, you accept them upon you? But the idea being that by definition, a woman can't be a dayan, we see that, as I said, there's the view of Tosfos, and he cites in here different rabbis who wanted to make maybe taka note that we can allow women. So it becomes harder, I have to be honest, it becomes harder and harder to argue purely halachically, and the Lieberman Tshuva is not really convincing because it doesn't deal with the issue, the real issue. Now, what is the real issue? I think the real issue is what we saw last class, the OU statement, clergy in the synagogue. As I said, I find it hard to see how, even from the OU's perspective, you can have any opposition, first of all, to a woman poseket, and second of all, to a chaplain. I don't see that as a clergy function. Of the whole point of the OU's position paper is they argue about the synagogue, that the synagogue is a place where you need to have higher levels of tzniut, the idea of, let's say, a woman in charge or giving speeches all the time. Also, the role of the synagogue, it goes on and on. that's really not a chaplain. And that's not, the chaplain's job is helping people. And that's not also being a teacher in a school. So in terms of a title, rabbi, fine, maybe you can adopt the Lieberman approach that rabbi doesn't, should only be for men, but to still have some sort of ordination. And even for the OU, if it's not titled rabbi and it's not in a synagogue, there has to be room, even in the OU statement, for some sort of recognition that women have accomplished things. And again, their whole point is rabbis in the synagogue. The clergy, the question as it was asked. I have the paper right here. Let me just read it to me. Here, I'll show you. This is what they were asked. And this is the only thing. Is it halakhically acceptable for a synagogue to employ a woman in a clergy function? What is the broadest spectrum of professional roles within a synagogue? That's the only thing. And in the first paragraph, it tells you that this goes beyond halakha. It goes to fundamental issues in our hashkafat olam about Masorah. The tension pits egalitarianism against the time-honored tradition. But this has nothing to do with ordination per se, the OU statement. When I say ordination, what is ordination? Ordination is a declaration that Madam X or Mr. X achieved certain proficiency in Jewish texts, and we're attesting to that. That could be given, that ordination could be given not just for synagogues. It could be given for all sorts of, you can run a Hillel. Hillels like to have rabbis. You could, chaplains, the chaplaincy. I don't see anything in the OU statement in opposition to ordination per se, other than perhaps using the title rabbi and working in a synagogue. And if you work in a synagogue, the OU statement doesn't care what title you use. So there's still, I think, even for the OU, I think outside the synagogue, there is plenty of room for women's ordination. So where does this then leave us with? If you look at... David Novak. So what's going on with David Novak? David Novak, really such a great mind, David Novak, in so many areas, in philosophy and halacha. Very few people have achieved as much, I should say, as David Novak. And not just in the Jewish world, in the non-Jewish world also, he's recognized as a very important figure. And you can go online, and just a short video, which came out recently, not a few years ago, in which he explains his support for Orthodox Smicha. Furthermore, you can find his daughter. Here she is. Marian Novak, who got Smicha from Maharat, and she says to Rabbi Gill's student, Professor Lieberman's response does not apply. And how could it not apply? Well, David Novak says as follows. David Novak writes to his daughter, and he says about Lieberman. He says, before he gets to that, he says that Yeshivat Maharat is careful to remain within the bounds of halacha by not ordaining women to roles that are prescribed by halacha. Lieberman's responsum does not apply to the yeshiva or any of its graduates. This is a little difficult, I think, because Lieberman is speaking about the title rabbi. And I would phrase it differently. If Yeshivat Maharat was ordaining people, but they were completely halachic, Lieberman is still opposed to it if they use the title rabbi. But Yeshiva Maharat did not use the title rabbi. It only used the title Maharat at first. Then it started using the title rabbah or even rabbi. There's no question that this is against Lieberman, but not the title Maharat, I don't think. And Novak acknowledges that he says that, got these ads here in the middle of it. He acknowledges that Lieberman might have opposed any clerical role for women, but in his tshuva, he's only citing classical sources that only men may be dayanim. And therefore, if a woman, it's not, if you keep within halacha and don't call her rabbi, that's how I would interpret Lieberman, it might be okay. But then he goes further. Novak says, And this, I think he's correct. He says as follows, as one of those who solicited Professor Lieberman's responsum, although it is only addressed to five members of the Talmud faculty, he says, I know that in the atmosphere of the conservative movement, then as now, no halachic distinctions would have been kept by the increasing egalitarian leadership and membership of the movement. Even the seminary itself was already being led by the late Professor Gerson Cohen, whose egalitarian views had been made public. That is why I was opposed to the ordination of women by the Jewish Theological Seminary beginning in 1983, and why it is quite consistent with my full support of the very different ordination of women, such as yourself by Yeshiva Maharat. What he's saying, what Novak is saying, is that it's not just Lieberman's responsum. It's the fact that the conservative movement was going full-blown into egalitarianism. They already had counted women to a minion, but there were to be no distinctions between men and women. And that is how, and a woman could be a dayan, a woman could be a witness. All the things that the halacha prescribes only men. And what Novak said is that the ordination of women, which is the least halachically objectionable of all these things, is part and parcel of the conservative movement's complete abandonment of halacha in the direction of full egalitarianism. In such circumstances, Novak said, of course, I had to oppose it completely. However, when you're dealing with an ordination of women, now he doesn't say what I say about the titles. I'd have to ask Rabbi Novak, does he go along with Lieberman that it makes a difference in the title? But what Novak is saying is that an ordination where the women do something in the synagogue and it's completely halachic and it's not tied in to an egalitarian sentiment, that's something that he sees as not objectionable. I only mention this. We're not dealing with Novak per se or the issue of the Yeshiva Maharat, but just because Novak's point, and this has been repeated by others, is that you can't puzzle Orthodox ordination when it's halachic by citing Lieberman. You can cite other reasons, but you can't do it by citing Lieberman. We will, however, next week see, and next week will indeed be the last class. We will finish. We will see Rav Herschel Schechter tries to do exactly that. A bit ironic, but we will see it, that the great posting Rav Herschel Schechter, in his opposition to women rabbis, lo and behold, he goes to Lieberman. I'll read to you what Halivni has to say about this in his memoir, looking back at it. And finally, and this might even be the last thing we do, I will tell you about, I promise this, and I'll get to it, Rabbi Dov Zlotnick, his mussar to me on this very issue, what I wrote, what I thought I was saying the truth. We'll see what Rabbi Zlotnick has to say. Now, I see it's already 9:28, but I want to read 3 minutes. Actually, let me just finish it off this, and I'll take the questions, and then we'll be able to start with Schechter next class and end it. I want to read you what Professor Halivni says. If you look in Halivni's memoir, wonderful book, The Book and the Sword, he tells the whole story beginning 104. He even tells us how he was going to be, he had a very good relationship with Gerson Cohen. And he was like taking over after Lieberman. He was going to hold the place of Lieberman for Cohen that Lieberman held for Finkelstein. And he talks about how he began to feel uncomfortable at the seminary, how he started researching, could we find a way to allow women to become rabbis? He talks about how once at a faculty meeting, he gave his opinion, and the chancellor, Gerson Cohen, ordered me to sit down. That elicited a protest from Rabbi Joel Roth, who would later write the responsum supporting women's ordination. Later, it was decided that he was giving Divrei Torah Friday night at the seminary service, and he speaks about how Gerson Cohen didn't like that either. And then he continues after when Lieberman died and the conflict he had, and until he felt he had to leave the seminary. He said that the implications of the process, that halachic decisions, and again, they're seen this as halachic decisions. Today, many in the Orthodox world don't see it as halachic, but Halivni and Lieberman and Frankis and the rest of them, Al-Faur, they all saw this was a halachic. He writes about how he had to leave the seminary. He said the reforms that the seminary adopted were interpreted to mean that halakha had bound to modernity. He said that if you have one infraction, that could be isolated. But when in the present climate, he said to do away with halakha, female ordination, because of the media, because of the modern temper, because of what outside, the mores, that word I used last class, of the outside world, he said halakha is then reduced to the status of folklore. But this is not halakha, Halivni says. A halakha that yields to anybody or anything cannot be divine. It shakes the foundation. And because of that, he writes a letter, which he publishes here explaining why he had to leave. And he begins the letter, he ends the letter with famous lines, which are not original to him. It's with Ernst Simon. And he tells us it's from Ernst Simon. But he talks, this whole letter talks about how what the seminary is doing now to update halakha is not in line with Jewish tradition. It's not, he says that the Jew knows no other way of reaching out to God other than through halakha. He knows no way to penetrate the highest recesses of spirituality except through halakha. And then he goes on, but what are they doing with halakha here? They're deciding halakha based upon the passing sentiments, not in terms, they're not studying it. They're not taking their time. They're not treating it seriously. He says as follows. He says, I cannot participate in the vote on women's ordination. Remember, I told you what the numbers were. Halivni wouldn't participate. He says, I cannot participate in the debate on a religious issue of major historical significance where the traditional making decision process is not honored. Its specific instructions as to who is qualified to pass judgment is not sufficiently reckoned with. How can the seminary vote for who's going to be admitted to the rabbinical school? Anyone can vote? It should only be the Talmid HaChachamim. How can you make a policy dealing with Jewish law and give it to people, the only people who are not Talmudic scholars? He says this is a mitzvah b'abei avera, even if you say you're going to strengthen tradition. And then he says, and I'll end with this, it is my personal tragedy that the people I daven with, I cannot talk to. And the people I talk to, I cannot daven with. In other words, who does he daven with? He davens with from people. These could be from people at the seminary, or they could be from people, Hasidim. I daven with him many times. I once ran into him on the first night of Pesach, and he lived up by the seminary, and I lived on the Upper West Side at 95th Street. I'm walking outside, and who I see walking down? Halivni. I'm like, what are you doing down here? He says he's looking for a shul that they're going to do challah, first night of Pesach. So I took him. We went into OZ, which is right around where I lived. OZ doesn't do halal on the first night of Pesach in the show. Ashkenazim generally don't do that. Oh, Hasidim do it. There's non-Hasidim don't. So I took him to Chabad, which at that time I think was like 92nd Street on Columbus. Let me tell you, I was shocked. First of all, I was shocked that the rabbis in Chabad knew who he was, but I was even more shocked, the kavod they gave him. So Halivni says, the people I daven with, I can't talk to, because the people... I shouldn't say the people at the seminary he davens with. The people he davens with when he went to the Chabad minyan with me, and when he davened with Hasidim and all them, he can't talk to them. He can't talk to them about his scholarship, things like that. And then he says, and the people I talk to, that is at the seminary, I can't daven with, because they're not davening with Machitza, and they're in the Sim Shalom Siddur. These are the people that he talks to, the conservative rabbis. It's not a proper Siddur. They've taken out so much. And then he says as follows. However, again, I'll read it. It's my personal tragedy that the people I daven pray with, I cannot talk to, and the people I talk to, I cannot daven with. That statement was made by the philosopher Ernst Simon. What comes next, however, is original to Halivni. And he says as follows. However, when the chips are down, I will always side with the people I daven with. For I can live without talking. I cannot live without davening. So at the end, when forced to make a choice between the people he could talk to, the scholars at the seminary, or the people he can daven with, namely from a Yidden, his huntsman, he says he had to make a choice and he had to leave the seminary because it no longer was a place that was religiously comfortable for them there. And once he left the seminary, he became an Orthodox rabbi. He was appointed the Mara D'Asra of the shul I used to go to sometimes on the Upper West Side, Orech Eliezer. It began in Louis Finkelstein's apartment, living with Davin there, and then it moved to the youth hostel, and he was the functioning rabbi. All decisions are made by him. And that is the tale, and we will continue with one more class. I just want to wrap it up, probably only maybe 20, 30 minutes, wrapping it up, even 20 minutes, and then I still have we'll make some final comments. It will have taken us 18 weeks, I think, 4.5 months to deal with Shaul Lieberman. I'll try to wrap it up. And also, I still have some things I want to get to. Those of you who emailed me who had questions and comments, I'll get to it next week. Let me take the questions. We've gone a little further, longer this time. Let me take some of the questions. So someone privately emails me that Karen Kirschenbaum is Rabbi Zlotnick's, Dov Zlotnick's daughter. So very suitable that she would give that talk. Dov Zlotnick's wife was a great artist, and she did nice portraits of Lieberman as well. Rabbi Shudnow says that Gerson Cohen told me that he had to ordain women or the movement would lose its constituents. You got to be with the people. If you're not with the people, you're going to lose it. And the conservative with a small C faction, the Union of Traditional Judaism, was not able to get off the ground because the conservative movement as a whole had moved to the left. And so I'm really not sure what the opponents wanted Gerson Cohen to do. Had he held firm against it, they would have brought in another chancellor. And it was reaching the point, it was reaching a breaking point, because in the pews, the rabbinical assembly, the pressure was too much. You can imagine them saying, for instance, that, okay, well, we're not going to, we'll give our loyalty to the place in California. They'll ordain women. Maybe they would have started doing it. Another institution could have opened up. The rabbinical assembly itself could have started ordaining women. The problem was you can't have a situation where the conservative rabbis in the field and the conservative synagogues are demanding something. If the seminary is not going to give it to them, then they don't need the seminary. He was between a rock and a hard place. Yes, Professor Fatwar sued the seminary. He didn't succeed because how could he succeed? He argued that they were violating his contract because when they then admitted women for ordination, it meant that he couldn't teach them because he could not be involved in that. It went against his religious principles, and he had a contract, so they were violating his contract. That's a stretch. iPad asked, did all faculty members of JTS need to be Jewish? That is, can non-Jewish faculty vote on non-Jewish matters? Good question. I think practically they all were Jewish, but I don't know the answer to that. I shouldn't ask, has anyone in the administration had a vote? Yes. Yeah, so, I don't know if he had a non-Jew. It would be a very good question. You mentioned something, it came up recently, and it's worth noting. At one of the major universities, there was an election for the Orthodox group, and anyone was allowed to vote who was on the mailing list. So a lot of non-Orthodox were allowed to vote on this, including many on very much on the left. And there's some bad feelings, I was told, because of this. And I don't know what you're supposed to do in a case like that, but there should be something that just like a non-Jewish person, or I would think a non-religious person, shouldn't vote on this. If you're not Orthodox, you shouldn't be voting on something that affects the Orthodox Dominion. Chabad tried this often. What you do is you bring people to these small shuls where membership is cheap. You bring, 50 people there. They become members, and then immediately they have a new vote, and they vote out the current people, and they bring in the Chabad rabbi. I mean, I don't know how you stop that unless you change the constitution and say you have to be a member for 5 years or something like that. But Shmuel says, if Lieberman had chosen to leave JTS by the late 70s, having stuck with the institution for so many decades, would he have been welcomed by the Orthodox? Had Lieberman left for ideological reasons and said that I'm leaving for ideological reasons, he would have been, of course, he would have been welcomed. The Baal Tshuva is always welcomed, and he would have been... He would have had his pick of places to go. He had no problem going to YU had he left, but he didn't. That wasn't what he was interested in. It was really only by the late 70s, and he was already really retirement age, retiring then at that time anyway. That it was. I don't really know. I mean, he could have done it. It would have maybe been a difficult thing for his pride. The people who had looked down on him for so long to now welcome him, but he didn't need that. He had it in Bar Ilan, by the way. he was always welcomed and treated very well in Bar-Ilan, and that was where he felt at home. Rabbi Kelman says, I remember listening to a tape of the first ADOC conference and a speaker proposing that, and it is optional, takes upon herself, Achi of Mitzvah say, that they can blow shofar for men. Rabbi Yoel Ben Nun has a piece in which he holds, I don't know if it's L'maisa, but at least he thinks this is the halacha, that women can accept upon themselves mitzvahs and have the same obligations as men. Rav Yoel Ben Nun, he's not one of the great halacha authorities. He's more known for Bible studies. He's an expert in that, but he's hardly an Am Haaretz in halacha. He's a very reputable rabbi. He's much more learned in Talmud and halacha than a lot of the rabbis we hear about in America. So we're not dealing with someone who just came out of rabbinical school and is making a name for himself. We're dealing with an authentic Talmud Chacham of the highest order and in Tanakh and other things and very qualified in halacha as well. He argued that. iPad says, what about what's written in Halivni's autobiography there? One generation of women who take on all the mitzvot, the next generation will be obligated. That's he wants to make this argument in his the unpublished responsa. After explaining why women can't take it on, he says this is a possible approach. But then it seems he retracted this because he didn't publish it, and it was only if everyone would go along with this. That was what he put forth. That was, as he says, as a shas adchak, where he thought that perhaps this could be a direction. If women, if the push was such that you need to have women rabbis in JTS, this is perhaps an approach that could be adopted. But it was never going to be adopted, and it was all theoretical. There's no problem with an Orthodox rabbi arguing this theoretically. You could find all sorts of, I've made this point in the past, that everything is context. If a rabbi today were to write a tshuva explaining that a woman could be a rabbi, immediately he's not could be counted a minyan, immediately he's not Orthodox, by definition. But yet, 200 years ago, before this was a real issue, any rav could do that. It's just another theoretical pill. I found two sources, one in the 19th century, one in the 18th century, that argue that a woman could be counted a minyan. If you go by the Ramban, Felix Durabana, whatever, they make an argument. Was this a real argument? No woman's being counted for a minyan, but it's a theoretical argument. So it's the same thing like Halivni's argument. I'm sure you can find people who make that as well. And Moshe says, the situation with women rabbis reminds me of how Mordechai Kaplan pushed Louis Ginsburg out as a posek. He says on page 454, Tradition Renewed, Ginsburg is clear as he tells the rabbis to keep their hands off the law. Yeah, that's we've discussed this again and again. I'm going to read you something next class. I didn't get to it today from the proceedings of the Committee on Jewish Law. This has always been an issue between the halacha authorities at the seminary and the rabbis. The rabbis were always more liberal. Remember what we saw. Lieberman goes to all this effort, all this trouble to come up with a new ketubah because Finkelstein tells him we need to come up with this. And what is the response of some of the rabbis in the field? This looks like it's an Orthodox thing. We don't need this. So the rabbis in the field were always much more liberal, and that's been a history. That's been an issue from the beginning, that the rabbis are more liberal than the Talmudists. Susanna says, why should men get smicha either, the title rabbi? Because what Lidin would say, that a man can be a dayan. So it's a zecher from Dayanos. And it's a continuation of being a dayan. I guess you could say, well, no one today could be a dayan. Could have real smicha. That is of the original sort. Yeah. So if no one can have smicha, we all should have different titles. But Lieberman explains in his tshuva, though they didn't do that though. They did continue with the title rabbi, and therefore It remained exclusively to men. It's weak, I think. I think the OU's approach is a much better approach. I think it's a very weak argument. Mel says, many Ashkenazi shuls say halal on the first two nights of Pesach. Where do they get this from, Mel? Is, you tell me, many of you from different menhagim. As far as I know, this is not Litvish and it's not the Yeki. It comes from Hasidus. Am I wrong? Is there not Hasidic minhag as well to say halal the first night in shul?
The Rav was very much in favor, I believe.
The Rav. Very much. But is this a tradition, or is this a
person? Yeah, so I don't know. I have to look it up. But he felt it's like Pesach night is special, and I think that is true. Many Ashkenazi shuls do say it.
But it's not. I wouldn't be surprised. This is a Brisker thing, not Minhag Yisrael.
Yeah, that could be. I just don't know offhand.
Okay. Michael says, I'm going to skip the private thing. Someone just sent me the Yehudi HaKadosh is quoted as saying, those I can pray with, I cannot talk to. Those I can talk with, I cannot pray with. Okay, I did not know that. So that's, it goes back. Of course, he's using it in a different way, but that's, I had no idea about that. And I'm going to save that. That's amazing. And B, finally, I guess it's Baruch. I'm leaving out the main issue. How about female Hasidisha Rebbes, like the maid of Lemire, I guess? Okay, well, yeah, we'll leave that to the Hasidim to bring it out. And so Rabbi Shinnah says the JTS Simicha, the originals is Rabbi and Chacham. Okay. With that, I thank you all. Finally, Shmuel says the Rav used to walk 45 minutes to daven a Chabad Minyan Sehara. So if anyone could find out for next class, is this the Rav came up with all sorts, not just the Rav, his father and his grandfather, original ideas, Minhagim. Is this something, did any shul in Lita actually do this? Or is this something that the Soloveitchiks came up with themselves? Or maybe it's Minhag Agra. A lot of these things that the Rav did is actually Minhag Agra. But Minhag Agra was also not the Minhag. In Vilna, even, they didn't hold a Minhag Agra. Did the Rav, by the way, speak of Pesach, did anyone know, did the Rav use two matzahs on Pesach night or three? I think he used three. But, okay, thank you all. Rabbi.
Thank you. Okay, next week, please go out. 19 is a good, that's, we finished the cycle, you know, 19 years, 19 weeks. So that's the Jewish calendaric cycle. And of course, that will end 2021. So we timed it perfectly. And then in 2022, please God, we'll be starting a new series. We'll announce the topic soon. We are working on, I mean, whatever, we'll put that out soon. So please God, but thank you. We look forward to the concluding 19th lecture next week. Okay.
Is it 19th or is it 18th?
Oh, maybe you're right. 18. Okay. Who, 18 next high, whatever number high. It is, make up a nice speech. So 18, high life, it's better. Yes, that's a Jewish number, right? You see who, when if it was 20, I'd say I'd make two minyanim for the men and the women. Can make up whatever you want. You just make the truck. You know, that's a famous story. They asked the Dubna Magid, how does he have a mashal for anything? So he says, it's like the guy, he shoots the arrow. And wherever it lands, he draws a thing. So he says, I come up with the mushroom first, and then I look for something to put it to. So, you know, you just make it up. Anyway.
I will say, for next week, I'll look it up. I'll see if there's any Ashkenazic sources, non-Hasidic.
I'll try to look it up.
For Hallel, Pesach night. Yeah.
I wonder if Rav Shachar talks about it. Then Nefesh
HaRav. He does. He does speak about it. David Eisen says, the Rav used two matzot. Very nice. But her husband, Rav Lechenstein, Mrs. Tovachenstein used two, but her husband used three. Okay, I'll get to this next
one. And in itself, that's interesting that the husband and wife didn't share the same matzah. That's already already very modern. Okay, nice to hear. It's always good to get from Beit Shemesh the good information. Okay, tomorrow, Jeremy England finishes three-part series on Torah Talking to Scientists. Wednesday, Dr. Sokolow is continuing his series on Tanakh. And then Thursday, Rav Aviyat Tabori giving the Parsha Shir, and then I have the Siddur Shir Friday morning. Okay, we'll look forward to learning with you, and everybody should be well, and please invite a friend. That's always we ask, but we mean it seriously. That's the best advertising. And okay, everybody should be safe, be well. I know lots of places are closing down. This is not, I don't know, maybe in the States, I'm not sure as much, but here in Canada, we're sort of back to March 2020. And let's just hope that the outcomes are much better, which so far they are. Let's hope it keeps that way and gets even better. Okay, everybody should be well and have a Laila Tov. And thank you very much.
Laila Tov.
Laila Tov.